I guess to me, calling it a war simplifies it. There are no two sides in equal defense of each other. It's a merciless genocide that's being committed against people who are unable to leave, unable to get shelter, unable to get medical attention. You know, it's wholesale slaughter, state-sanctioned genocide. And what effect does that have on an entire population, on generation after generation? It's human devastation on an unimaginable scale. I mean, Palestinian children close their eyes and see nothing but devastation. They open their eyes to the same, and they grow up fluent in a language of grief and trauma. Trauma is like a second language to them, essentially. It rearranges their lives. It interrupts it, if you will, over and over and over again, one onslaught after another. Their thoughts run on death, destruction, calamity. Under those conditions, the chronic traumatic stress becomes so, you know, common that it's their normal. You know, the trauma actually embeds itself in their cells. It alters their DNA. And that passes on one generation after another. It actually becomes generational. So talk about like developmental disruption. That's exactly what Israel is intent on, to disrupt lives, to disrupt the normal progression. It wants to constantly have one assault after another to disrupt a normal development from occurring.
So do we have any figures? Do we know what percentage of children are diagnosed? I mean, what about those who are never diagnosed, who may have some trauma or scars? I mean, do we have any idea of these consequences in terms of numbers?
I would tell people to, you know, to turn to DCI, Defense for Children International. They have amazing figures to, you know, they will document a lot of what's happening. But even then, I feel like that's scratching the surface of what's happening. I mean, even children in Gaza right now who are receiving psychosocial care, you know, for what happened during the last onslaught are being killed as of, you know, today and yesterday. And so how do you keep up? How do you keep track of who's suffering?
Regarding chemical, biological weapons, we've seen reports that Israel's potentially been using white phosphorus in the last days, and we know they did in 2009. I mean, what does that do to someone whose body, whose brain is still developing?
Oh, the effect that it would have on, like entire generations are going to suffer immeasurable consequences to their immune system, endocrine system, their neurological system. This is all very calculated, mind you. None of it is by accident. It's all very, very calculated and by design. These endocrine disruptors will affect fertility. When I was there in 2014, I saw children born with ambiguous genitalia, with all kinds of cancers. This is affecting so much more than just, you know, what you see on the surface. This is a very generational thing designed to destroy generation after generation after generation. All very calculated, and none of it by accident or just to create destruction on a large scale. It's designed to create destruction for generations to come, even in unborn children, if you will. So it's incomprehensible.
So, you know, Dina, lastly, we've seen a massive general strike all across Palestine, perhaps the biggest in Palestinian history. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Does it make you feel hopeful at all?
I think this is a monumental time in history. We're going to look back, and when people ask, where were you when this or that happened? Were you standing on the right side? Were you standing on the side of the oppressed? Did you choose to make a conscious effort to speak up even when it wasn't as popular or when, you know, wasn't good for your career or what have you? I do have hope. I will always have hope as a Palestinian. I think a lot more needs to be done. We need to see more than lip service. We need more than what's being done, because I feel like this world continues to fail Palestine in every conceivable way, but I do have hope.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Reacting to Israel's latest attacks on Gaza, the response from the majority of Western governments is just as you'd expect. Lackluster at best, and at worst, a complete whitewashing of Israeli crimes. Some European countries thought that it would be a wise idea to take a side, and of course they decided to pander to the Israeli lobby. Czech President Zeman ordered that an Israeli flag be raised over Prague Castle in a show of solidarity with the Israeli occupation, or as most would correctly put it, in a show of hostility to the Palestinians. The Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, also decided to fly the Israeli flag, which was raised over the Chancellery building in the capital, Vienna. Now, to say this was done in extremely poor taste is an understatement. Austria is a neutral country, at least officially, and Vienna has long boasted to be the world's capital of international diplomacy. It's home to one of the United Nations headquarters, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and many other international organizations. And this isn't just about violating supposed neutrality, but this move shows that the Austrian and Czech governments to be on the side of the Israeli occupation, on the side of the oppressors. The United Kingdom's Foreign Minister Dominic Raab condemned Hamas firing rockets at Israel, but of course said nothing of Israel's bombardment of Gaza, which has killed hundreds. This was followed up by a readout from the White House regarding U.S. President Joe Biden's call with Netanyahu, in which Biden reaffirmed Israel's, quote, right to defend itself, whatever that means. Joining me is Jennifer Levenstein. She's a freelance journalist, human rights activist, professor of Middle East Studies, and also works with Eyewitness Palestine. Thank you for taking the time, Jennifer. It's great to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jennifer, I want to start out with the Biden administration's response to what's happening now in Gaza. What are your thoughts on what Jen Psaki, the White House spokesperson, said, Secretary of State Blinken? I mean, what did you think of their assessment and response to what Israel is doing right now in Palestine?
I think their responses have been absolutely criminal. And I don't honestly know if they are criminal intentionally or whether these two people are just incredibly ignorant. When you hear the President of the United States saying that the aggressor in a conflict has the right to self-defense, there's something very, very wrong with that response. The aggressor in any military situation is not the one defending itself. So I've been very disappointed both with his response and also with Secretary of State Antony Blinken's response, who said yesterday that there was no equivalence between the Hamas organization and Israel, and said that Israel had the right to self-defense. So once again, he's got it completely backwards.
Okay, so I mean, what do you say to people who would respond that basically, you know, Palestinians, that Hamas, they're the ones who started everything, and that basically they're responsible for any civilian casualties? I mean, what do you respond to people who say that?
I would say that if they're looking at a situation in a very, very short-term setting, that they can possibly come away with that view. But even if they take into consideration the events of the last 2 weeks, Israel is the aggressor. Israel went into the Al-Aqsa Mosque and beat up worshipers during the holiest holiday for Muslims. Israel is expelling citizens from the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Israel is the one who's backing up Jewish settlers who are running around in East Jerusalem and elsewhere saying death to Arabs, and we're burning Arabs today. Israel is the one that is causing displacement, dispossession, home demolitions, you name it. That is the aggressor. That's not somebody defending itself. The responses to these actions by Israel are resistance. resistance is legal under international law in whatever form the resistors wish to take.
So, I mean, speaking of international law, at the United Nations Security Council, just in the past week, the United States three times blocked a statement which called for a ceasefire. Everyone else in the UN Security Council was in favor of it. But the United States blocked it because of language that would have condemned Israel's actions. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I call the veto power in the United Nations Security Council, I call it the tyranny of the veto, because, of course, pretty much world public opinion is on the side of the Palestinians right now. It's a very, very small percentage of people who actually support what Israel is doing. For the United States to block any language supporting a ceasefire is a form of tyranny. And it's also, once again, it's criminally sadistic, in my view. We're talking about an action right now that has led to the deaths of 213 people in the Gaza Strip, 61 of them children, 35 approximately of women. More children have died in Gaza than Hamas fighters. There is something terribly wrong with that. It's all completely against international law because the Gaza Strip is illegally occupied by Israel. That's as plain and as clear as day for anyone who wishes to read international law.
So, I mean, what does that say when, in the middle of all this, the Biden administration, they just approved a new weapons sale to Israel worth $735 million just on Monday, May 17th?
It's my understanding is that it was approved slightly earlier than that. That doesn't change the fact that they are approving more military aid to Israel on top of $3.8 billion of aid every year. And it is in direct contravention of what is called the Leahy Law in the U.S. Congress, which says that it's illegal to give military aid to any country using it to violate the human rights and the civil rights of another people. And of course, this aid is not only violating people's rights, it's murdering them outright.
You know, I think it's extremely sobering what you just said, that more children have died than Hamas fighters. I mean, this is astonishing.
14 families have been wiped out in the Gaza Strip in the last week. 14 entire families. They'll no longer appear on the civil record. That is hard for anyone to imagine, but it is just, it's indescribable to imagine that many people, that many family units just disappearing under the rubble of a bombardment that is so completely illegal and so aggressive, such as it's a crime of evil. I can't think of another word for it.
And just lastly, I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are on the motivations behind this, on the Likud party. I mean, do you think that perhaps this is something to do with what's happening internally in Israel with Netanyahu? Do you think there's some ulterior motive that's going on here and not just Hamas, like they claimed?
I do. I think there are two parallel things happening right now. I think the greater goal of Israel is for a greater Israel. It is to have a nation that has no Palestinians in it. It is to isolate Palestinians in the West Bank into 165 disconnected enclaves. That is without doubt. It's a form of ethnic cleansing. Some people have actually started to call this a genocide. At the same time, Netanyahu will do absolutely anything to stay in power, to avoid going to prison. He's a corrupt politician. He's an unethical politician. And, you know, the words to describe somebody like him who is so utterly criminal and without any conscience whatsoever. I mean, he's psychopathic. And his actions, I think, display this. He doesn't care about the deaths of people in the Gaza Strip or the West Bank, or for that matter, in Israel. He doesn't care. He cares about power. And that is something that we should all be very sober about when analyzing this situation.
As Israel continues to bomb Gaza, protests in support of Palestine have erupted all across the world. In London alone, an impressive 100,000 people took to the streets in a show of solidarity. Protesters marched onto the Israeli embassy in London, demanding an end to the Israeli violence, chanting, "Free Palestine," and "Israel is a terror state." A petition on the British government's own website calling on the UK to impose sanctions on Israel received over 300,000 signatures. This means the matter could potentially be raised and discussed in the House of Commons, as the British Parliament usually considers bringing up petitions for debate if they reach a minimum of 100,000 signatures. In France, several protests were held across many cities in support of Palestine. However, a large gathering that was planned in Paris was banned. People still showed up regardless to express their support, but were met with water cannons and tear gas from the French police. In Lebanon and Jordan, dozens of people went to their respective borders with occupied Palestine in an attempt to storm them and cross over. And in another remarkable show of solidarity, Italian dock workers at the port of Livorno refused to load weapons and explosives that were headed for the Israeli occupation, stating that they would not be an accomplice in the massacre of the Palestinian people. All around the world, people continued to show support for Palestine with large protests in several cities across Canada, Germany, and cities all across the world, such as Warsaw, New York, Cape Town, Madrid, Sydney, and many more. Popular support for Palestine is real. It is widespread. It is international, and it is powerful. And although many governments do not reflect the will of their people, the average person does know right from wrong. And they're starting to see through the whitewashing of Israeli crimes and apartheid. It is undeniable that public opinion is shifting, and it's shifting in the right direction. It's shifting in support for Palestine. On May 18th, 2021, a general strike was held to protest Israel's crimes in Palestine, and participation was at record levels, with millions of Palestinians taking part from the West Bank to Gaza to Jerusalem to Haifa, Ramallah, Bethlehem, and many more. Shops were closed, people took to the streets, and they marched in protest of Israel's ruthless bombings, of their plans to evict people in Sheikh Jarrah, and all of the occupation in its entirety. Once again, the death toll in Gaza speaks for itself. The bombed out hospitals, clinics, schools, shelters, roads speak for themselves. What Israel is doing is not just horrific, it is evil. No sane or rational person can look at this and call this defense. This is not defense. This is offense. This is aggression. This is a violent, calculated destruction of public infrastructure. It's a massacring of the Palestinian people. Almost one third of the casualties are children. Are they also Hamas fighters? Israel has 10 casualties versus hundreds on the Palestinian side. You cannot inflict 10 times, 20 times more casualties on someone smaller and weaker than you and then pretend that you are the victim. And we constantly hear that Israel has the right to defend itself. Really? What about Palestinians? Palestinians don't have the right to defend themselves when they are being massacred. Palestinians don't have the right to defend themselves from Israeli bombs. Palestinians don't have the right to defend themselves from Israeli occupation. You want us to believe that Palestinians are a threat when they don't even have an air force, a navy, or any conventional armed forces? Israel kills 10 times more people. Israel drops bombs on hospitals, roads, schools. It kills journalists, medics. It levels the buildings of the international press. And you want us to believe that that's defensive and that Palestinians are the problem? You cannot talk about defense when you are in a position of power and you are the aggressor, when you are occupying and colonizing someone else's land. Israel is not a victim, nor is it acting out of self-defense. The Israelis are colonizers. It is the Palestinians who are defending themselves. The Palestinians are resisting Israeli occupation. They're defending themselves and their land from colonizers. This is why Israel tries so hard to smear those who expose its crimes, to character assassinate them and shift the conversation away from its ethnic cleansing of Palestine and its brutal military occupation and make it about personal smears. The Israeli lobby spends an awful lot of time and energy waging war against those critical of the Zionist regime. The mainstream media is more than happy to cover for them, and this is why we cannot allow what is happening in Gaza, what has been happening in Palestine for the last 73 years, to be whitewashed and erased by them. Despite the overwhelming support and backing of the West for Israel, people must never be afraid to document Israel's crimes and to expose the true nature of the Zionist regime. The support for Palestine is fundamentally rooted in the defense of human rights, in anti-imperialism, anti-racism, and their cause is a just and noble one. Palestinians need all the support they can get, and we will give it to them. Thanks for tuning in, and long live the resistance. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
The limelight.
Cosmologists have unveiled a trove of fresh data, but the measurements do not settle earlier questions about the universe's unexpected smoothness, says David Castelvecchi, researcher, in an article titled "The Most Detailed 3D Map of the Universe Ever Made." Stay tuned for more. A survey of the southern sky has reconstructed how mass is spread across space and time. In the biggest study of its kind, the data provides striking evidence that dark energy, the force that appears to be pushing the universe to accelerate its expansion, has been constant throughout cosmic history. The Dark Energy Survey, DES, collaboration revealed its results in an online briefing on May 27th. And in several papers posted online. The DES team observed the sky between 2013 and 2019 using a 570 megapixel camera at Victor M. Blanco Telescope at Cerro Toledo Inter-American Observatory in Chile. The survey covered one quarter of the southern sky, and its exposures included 300 million galaxies. "It's an incredibly powerful data set," comments Catherine Haymans, an astronomer at the University of Edinburgh, UK. The researchers grouped the galaxies by color to get a rough indication of each galaxy's distance from our own. As the universe expands, galaxies that are further away appear redder because their light waves have stretched out to longer wavelengths. That way, the team was able to add a third dimension to its map. Looking further away also corresponds to looking to the past, so a 3D cosmic map provides a record of the universe history. By tracking how galaxies spread out over time, cosmologists can then indirectly measure the forces at play. These include the gravitational pull of dark matter, the invisible stuff that constitutes some 80% of the universe mass and dominates the formation of galaxies and cluster of galaxies. To better reveal the presence of dark matter, the DES team analyzed the shapes of 100 million of more distant galaxies. Because gravity curves space, the cosmologists were able to map large concentrations of dark matter in the closer regions of the universe by seeing how their gravity squeezes the images of galaxies further away, a phenomenon called weak gravitational lensing. "We observe our images of background galaxies to be slightly distorted," explained DES member Alexandra Amen in an online briefing. mapping galaxies and dark matter in 3D also allows researchers to investigate dark energy, the force that's pushing the universe expansion to accelerate. The nature of this mysterious force is one of the major open problems in cosmology. All evidence so far has suggested that it is uniform throughout space and time, and DES has now provided the most stringent test of that hypothesis. When combined with data from other surveys, its 3D map has helped to cut the error margins down to about 3%, says DES member Michael Troxell of Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Ofer Lahav, a leading DES member of University College London, says that the result is a triumph for the standard model of cosmology, which assumes dark energy to be constant. This will make it harder for cosmologists to support alternative models in which dark energy is a tangible medium that could wither away in the future. DES also found the universe to be slightly smoother than expected, confirming findings that the collaboration first reported in 2017. Lensing is persistently low compared to what the universe dictates, said Amon, who is a cosmologist at the Kavli Institute for Particle Cosmology in Menlo Park, California. In addition to DES, two other major weak lensing projects have reported a similar puzzling result. The Hyper Supreme CAM survey done by the National Astronomical Observatory of Japan's Subaru Telescope in Mauna Kea, Hawaii, and the Kilo Degree survey at one of the European Southern Observatory telescopes in Chile, led by Heymans. All three surveys have found slightly less lensing and, therefore, slightly less concentration of dark matter than would be expected based on the prevailing model of cosmology. When experimental uncertainties are factored in, the measurements are still broadly consistent with the standard model. Heymans says it will be interesting to combine the results of the three-week lensing surveys into one analysis to get a more precise measure of the possible discrepancy. There is more to come from DES. The latest results were based on its first 3 years of data taking, out of a total of 6 years. Starting next year, cosmology will take a major leap, with two new observationists, the Vera Rubin Observatory in Chile and the European Space Agency's Euclid Space Telescope. Both will conduct weak lensing studies of unprecedented depth, and they are going to do this on the full sky, says Heymans.
Around the world with reporters.
Activists are galvanizing opposition to the government's planned controversial policing bill, which is now close to becoming law, highlighting a number of issues as more Kill the Bill protests are planned.
It's a massive assault on our democratic right to protest in this country. Let's be clear here. This is specifically aimed at the environmental movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding that we tackle the climate emergency, and the Black Lives Matter movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding justice for black people. And when the government saw these two movements in the summer of last year taking to the streets as they did, they decided that they needed to put in place the most draconian legislation.
Many anticipate a new wave of protest as concerns over the right of assembly grow.
And I think this will be the government's poll tax movement moment, and we'll see thousands and thousands and thousands of people in cities right across the country, as we have over the last 3 months, stepping up the campaign against this bill. But it's an absolute disaster for democracy in Britain.
The bill could also have a devastating impact on other marginalised communities in Britain.
This government is conducting a culture war. That's what he's doing. He's trying to undermine and eliminate aspects of black culture, Muslim culture, traveller culture. And when you think that people have had a way of life for thousands of years, and now you're going to introduce legislation, rather than facilitating their way of life as British people within a multicultural democracy, you're actually going to introduce a law that denies them their very way of life.
Criticism of government plans will continue amid fears that the potential damage might be irreversible.
The Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill continues to see mass opposition up and down the country, with experts deeply concerned about the potential long-term impact on civil liberties. Richard Sudam, London.
At a summit in Brussels, EU leaders have taken the highly controversial decision to advance plans on the vaccination of children against COVID-19. The European Commission says more than 300 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine will have been delivered to EU member states by the end of this week.
If we continue like this, we have confidence that we will be able to safely reopen our societies. So we must now focus on consolidating this progress. One important element that we've been discussing is the vaccination of minors.
EU leaders have chosen to completely ignore a plea from the World Health Organization. The WHO clearly states that vaccinating children and other low-risk groups in the EU happens at the expense of health workers and high-risk groups in poorer countries.
The People's Vaccine Alliance is a coalition of more than 50 organizations. In an extensive survey of epidemiologists commissioned by the Alliance, two-thirds warned mutations could render current COVID vaccines ineffective within a year. Hence the need, they stress, to vaccinate the world, not just rich countries.
EU leaders are under enormous pressure to somehow save the bloc's floundering economy, and they see the vaccination of their own people as the key. Millions have lost their jobs in the EU. Young adults have been worst affected. Experts we have been speaking to say the EU has given young people limited skills, particularly when it comes to the digital economy.
We need to change and constantly update our educational systems. And not only educational, we need to speak about the learning as such, which is much wider concept than what is being taught in schools.
The EU is facing unparalleled economic and social crises. Critics say the vaccine rollout was happening much too slowly. Now, as it speeds up, it's perpetrating, quote, scandalous inequality in the context of poorer countries, according to the WHO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On April 6, 1994, an airplane carrying then Rwandan president Juvenal Habyarimana was shot down as it prepared to land in Kigali, killing everyone on board. Military commanders of Rwanda's Hutu-dominated republic announced the president's death, blaming the Rwandan Patriotic Front, RPF, an organization dominated by the rival Tutsi minority, for the attack. Within a few hours, the commanders ordered people of Hutu identity to spare no Tutsi in the country, including infants. The mass killings went on for around 100 days, leaving at least 800,000 people dead. During Habyarimana's years in power, France maintained close relations with him as part of its France-Afrique policy. The French assisted Rwanda militarily against the RPF during the country's civil war in the years before the massacre. In the first few days of the genocide, Paris launched a military operation to evacuate French expatriates from Rwanda, refusing to allow any Tutsis to accompany them. According to the Human Rights Watch, the French military presence after the killings also effectively helped the perpetrators of the genocide to escape to neighboring countries. The question of France's role and responsibility in the genocide has burned between the two nations for decades. However, ties have warmed under French President Emmanuel Macron. Macron made a symbolic visit to Rwanda after three decades of diplomatic tensions. His highly anticipated speech fell short of a formal apology. but he recognized his country's responsibility.
Ever since 27 years of bitter distance passed, 27 years of incomprehension, of a sincere attempt to get closer that was unsuccessful, 27 years of suffering for those whose intimate stories remain mishandled because of the antagonism of the memory, and so with modesty and respect by your side today, I come to recognize our responsibility.
Even though the French president tried to reconcile with Rwandan people, genocide survivors were disappointed at Macron's failure to offer a clear apology.
We remember the French who went to the checkpoints, who worked with the ex-government, and who helped them to distinguish between the Tutsis and the Hutus. I mean, it is very... we cannot forget that easily. We need to be honest. They have participated. They helped. It was time to say sorry, without going around it.
The official report of the latest inquiry in France's role in the genocide commissioned by Macron in 2019 said that Paris was responsible but not an accomplice. The report, along with the lack of an apology from Macron, shows that France still does not want to admit its complicity in the 1994 genocide.
Elections ended on Thursday after millions of Syrians cast their ballots on the 26th of May to choose one of the three presidential candidates as the nation's next leader. Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly, Hammoudeh Sabah, announced the final result in a press conference.
I am delighted and honored to announce the victory of Bashar Hafez al-Assad as the president of the Syrian Arab Republic. I express in the name of the Syrian People's Assembly our pride and appreciation and congratulations to our great Syrian people who voted for a free and great leader.
More than 13 million Syrians out of 14 million voted in favor of Assad. People filled the streets and main squares of major cities, celebrating what they say is a victory against all states that opposed the elections. Chanting slogans in support of President Bashar al-Assad, Syrians danced, sang, and expressed in all ways possible their feelings for their leader.
Western enemy countries' economic sanctions caused food and basic supply shortages in Syria, which forced Syrians to line up for hours at shop stores. Those countries today are definitely surprised to see those lines of people on the streets now expressing their love to President Assad and Syria. We will continue supporting Assad even if bread, water, food and gas are not available.
We are gathering today in all squares to tell all countries of the world that no country will defeat us, no matter how much plots they hatch. We are with Assad and we are steadfast. We all love President Assad.
Currently, Syrians' main demand is for President Assad to improve the economic situation in the country, which is suffering under harsh economic sanctions imposed unilaterally by the West and the United States. It's a historic moment in Syria, and Syrians have made that clear on the streets. They are celebrating victory over all states that wanted to forcibly topple the country's president for years, that they are the owners of this land and have the right to determine their country's future. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The president of the UN General Assembly visited Pakistan. Volkan Buzgar met senior Pakistani authorities, including Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi. His agenda includes regional and international issues, including Palestine, Kashmir, and the Afghan peace process. At a news conference, the president of the UN General Assembly made it clear no one can remain impartial in the face of Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians. Volkan said that political will shown by the General Assembly on Palestine must be used to force the UN Security Council for the resolution of this long-standing problem. During the 11-day Israeli aggression against the Palestinians, the United States blocked several attempts by other members in the UN Security Council to pass a resolution against Israel. Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi briefed the UN General Assembly President about the current situation in the disputed Kashmir region. Kashmir remains a disputed territory between India and Pakistan since 1947. Both countries fought wars and held dialogue, but have so far failed to break the stalemate. Among other issues that came up for discussion during the visit of the UN General Assembly President include the current situation in Afghanistan. Both sides agreed there is no military solution to the Afghan war.
and that all sides must seize the current opportunity for a peace deal. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
To some, it's the most anti-Israel country in Europe. To others, the most pro-Palestine. Ireland, a nation of nearly 5 million and a member of the European Union. Days after a ceasefire ended 11 days of fighting set off by Israeli provocations in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds, Ireland has become the first EU member state to condemn Israeli settlement activity.
The Dáil has unanimously supported the Sinn Féin motion, which recognizes that Israel has illegally de facto annexed large portions of Palestinian land, which is totally illegal in international law. So this is a momentous decision.
The parliament made other decisions too. It stopped short of adopting an amendment from small left-wing party People Before Profit that called for the Israeli ambassador to Ireland to be expelled.
Although it's disappointing that we have seen that we haven't got the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador, we still have to focus on moving forward with other matters. But in saying that, there's absolutely no support for the Israeli ambassador being in Ireland within the general public. I mean, that's evident across all social media platforms.
The latest move is one of several in Ireland to support the Palestinian cause. The most recent examples, the 2017 hoisting of the Palestinian flag over Dublin City Council to mark 50 years of Israeli occupation, the funding of multiple developmental and humanitarian projects in Gaza, and the 2018 introduction of the Occupied Territories Bill. Still to become law, the bill hands down hefty fines or jail sentences to anyone found guilty of importing or selling goods originating from the Golan Heights, East Jerusalem Al-Quds, or the illegal settlements in the West Bank. Slammed by Israel as an expression of full hostility, the bill and the latest condemnation are considered massive wins for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. What has helped foster Irish solidarity with the Palestinian cause? The country's own experience with British colonialism.
The Irish people's bloody struggle for independence from British rule has inspired an emotional connection with the Palestinian struggle, a connection that continues to inspire them to support the Palestinian cause and call for an end to the conflict through Palestinian self-determination. Said Pouriza, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah gave a televised speech to commemorate the 21st anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from the Israeli occupation. May 25, 2000 represents, as Said Nasrallah noted, the beginning of an era of victories for the resistance in the region. The most significant stance in this year's speech was a warning to the Israelis to keep their hands off Al-Quds and Muslim and Christian holy sites in Palestine.
The resistance in Gaza created a balance where they said any assault on Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds will lead to a military confrontation. The new equation that we need to reach is that if they touch Al-Quds, then there will be a regional war. This means all the resistance movements in the region cannot stand idly by if the holy city and the sanctities are under genuine threat. This is a genuine promise that the people of the resistance in the entire region will not forsake the holy city or the Muslim and Christian holy sites to be destroyed.
The leader of the resistance in Lebanon gave a detailed explanation of why the latest confrontation was exceptional and why its results yielded a victory for the Palestinians and a defeat for the Israelis. Experts believe the many victories for the resistance in Palestine are part of the era of triumph, which began in May of 2000.
All the past wars and victories from 2000 to 2006 in Lebanon to 2008 in Gaza until the last battle were all evidence of the accumulation of achievements for victory of the resistance. Today in Gaza in 2021, we saw the peak of the accumulated victories and the failure which is lived by the Israelis. The resistance was able to unite all the Palestinian people, and that victory was an extension of the victories in Lebanon. Now the Palestinian resistance is at the heart of the resistance front in the region, enforcing new realities.
The Lebanese celebrate May 25th as a national holiday, though the last Israeli soldier left South Lebanon on May 25th, 2000, signaling an end to over 18 years of invasions and occupation of Lebanon. The Lebanese official stance considers the Shabab Farms and Kfar Shuba Hills as Lebanese territory that should be liberated. celebration of Liberation Day this year in Lebanon has become intertwined with the victory in Palestine, while Lebanese recall that years of sacrifice and resistance against Israeli occupation led to liberty, they believe it is their duty to motivate the Palestinians to continue on that same path until they reach complete freedom. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The remaining signatories of the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, enter into a fifth round of talks aimed at reviving the agreement through the removal of U.S. sanctions and a return to full compliance by Iran.
The experts will continue the discussions in the working groups. In the meantime, the European Union, as coordinator, will continue the talks with all participants of the JCPOA and separately with the United States in view of finding common grounds for an agreement to take shape.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said the difficult issues that still need to be resolved have become less, although decisions must be made on the remaining differences.
We have made some progress on them, but we are not still in a position to say that we have a clear answer for them and a clear solution actually for these key issues. But I'm confident that we would be able to make progress this time and, if possible, conclude the negotiations, which I have to repeat, I'm not confident that it would be possible to conclude the negotiations, but there is the possibility.
Iran has been demanding the removal of all U.S. sanctions, including those imposed under other labels against individuals and entities under the former administration of Donald Trump. Iran has also made it clear it would only come back to full compliance after it has verified the effective removal of sanctions, demands that up until now have not been met. Araghchi says he's seen determination and seriousness by all parties involved to reach a conclusion in the coming days, a prospect that he admits is still not by any means certain. Homolezki, Vienna.
The UK Home Office is under the spotlight once more after Home Secretary Priti Patel oversaw an immigration raid under the guise of observing the implementation of the law, but which nonetheless outraged many.
There are other ways to uphold the rule of law and the practices and policies and rules and regulations of any government without sensationalising the misery of you know, people who are extremely marginalised, excluded, and many of which have, you know, travelled an awful long way to seek the safety and international protection of the United Kingdom.
In Scotland, despite hundreds turning out to prevent a similar immigration bust, Priti Patel reiterated that she believed British people supported and voted for such scenes.
The Home Secretary is completely delusional. I don't think there was ever a vote that said, do you agree to people being rounded up like cattle, denied their right to appeal, denied an opportunity for their family members to be informed that they have been rounded up, and to be deported or administratively removed from the United Kingdom.
The Windrush scandal also continues as part of the hostile environment to affect many people.
There are one and two and three generations of people being denied services, people being denied access to university places, people not being able to access medical treatments, denied opportunities to access social housing, and it is an absolute blight on this government.
Many people think that modern Britain is simply a far cry from the welcoming image which is often presented to the world.
The hostile environment created by the UK government continues to have a devastating impact on communities, with legal experts concerned about many cases of unlawful detainment and deportation. Richard Sudan, London.
Insightful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz.
The characteristics of an ideal president. The next point is addressed to the masses of the people. I wish to mention the characteristics that an ideal president should have. You people should see if this is really the case. These characteristics are not my personal viewpoints. It seems that anyone looking for the welfare of the country wants such a president. First of all, he should be competent. He should possess managerial qualities and managerial competence. Secondly, he should be religious. If he were irreligious, it would not be possible to trust him. An irreligious person will sell the country and its interests and people. Therefore, he should be religious. After that, he should be after justice and fight against corruption. This is one of the most important characteristics that should exist in a president. He should pursue justice in the real sense of the word and want to fight against corruption in the true sense of the word. He should have a revolutionary and jihadi performance. One cannot work with a pretentious and ceremonial manner. With all the fundamental issues that exist in the country, there is a need for a jihadi and revolutionary performance. He should have such a performance. He should believe in domestic capabilities. There are some individuals who do not believe in domestic capabilities at all. They repeat the same cliche that inside the country, it is only possible to build clay ewers. However, they do not know what is happening inside the country. Once a gentleman said something about our defensive capabilities. Then I said that we should hold on exhibition so that such gentlemen come and see what is happening in the country in terms of defensive capabilities. Presidential candidates should be really sure about the capabilities of the country. They should also believe in the youth. They should recognize the youth as the engine of the country's general movement, and they should trust them.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. To Allah.
aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. We looked into the life of Muhammad Iqbal from his birthplace in Punjab province of British India, now in Pakistan, to his academic studies in the University of Cambridge. Iqbal was a very learned man who was known for his political ideologies and philosophical theories. He is fondly remembered as a great poet and scholar. The political content of Muhammad Iqbal's poetry is one of the most fascinating aspects of his work. Except for a few poems, his entire poetic endeavor is tinged with the political concerns of his time. Both domestic and international political events shaped his poetry. He not only responded to political events in his verse, but also inspired his fellow Indian Muslims through his poetry to find a way out of the political dilemma in which the British colonial rule had put them. Stay with us as we looked into how Iqbal helped his fellow Indian Muslims aspire to a better future and guided them on the road to freedom.
Iqbal's message is addressed only to the youth. He calls them Royal Falcons. As held by Iqbal, the Royal Falcon has five characteristics. Iqbal wants the youth to catch hold of Falcon's characteristics as much as possible. The five good attributes of the Royal Falcon, as seen by Iqbal, are flying high. So Iqbal wants the youth to fly high for sure. The second attribute is keen eyesight. The youth can fly high only if they have keen eyesight. Its third attribute is that it does not build a nest, nor does it follow richness. The fourth attribute, it loves solitude, as it is a source of creativity. The last attribute, as told by Iqbal of the Royal Falcon, is it does not eat the prey hunted by others. Iqbal wants the youth to show these five attributes.
Allama's poetry consists of certain periods.
His poetry was at first as the poetry of the day. He would say at that time, "My Urdu poems are like a building made of clay." Little by little, his Persian poems came into existence. Among the first Persian poems were the familiar secrets and the mysteries of rapture. Such poems end with Javed Name, or perhaps with "What can be done, O Eastern people?"
Gradually, Iqbal changes from a national poet to the poet of the Islamic world. His versified story, "The Familiar Secrets and the Mysteries of Rapture," is first translated into English by Reynold Nicholson and published in the region. Years later, his Javedname is translated into German and Turkish in 1957 by those who study Islam, including Anna Marie Schimmel. The book is published in Munich, Hermann Hesse. The German writer and a winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature writes an introduction to Javedname, as requested by the translator. Hesse writes, "Sir Muhammad Iqbal belongs to three intellectual domains. His works are the outcome of these three intellectual domains: Indian intellectual domain, spiritual domain, and Western thoughts domain."